Case number is 10-5066. Activist Elizabeth, LLC, appellant versus United States Food and Drug Administration et al. Mr. Landman for the appellant, Mr. Clark for appellees.
When you are.
May it please the court, I'm Chad Landman with Axon, Veltrop, and Harkrider. We represent activist Elizabeth LLC. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal. Thank you. There are two issues before this court today. First, the district court erred in finding the NCE statute ambiguous and in allowing FDA to apply a strict molecular structure-based approach that ignores activity altogether. Specifically, the district court misread this court's decision in Abbott v. Young, and the district court's decision did not address the statutory issue. FDA's structure-based approach is contrary to the text, structure, and purpose of the new chemical entity statute. Instead, the statute compels FDA to apply an activity-based approach. The second issue before this court is that the district court erred in refusing to consider FDA's long history in applying an activity-based approach. The district court fundamentally misunderstood our citation to FDA's manual of practice and procedure, which I'll refer to as MAP. As a result, the district court failed to consider the numerous instances in which FDA applied an activity-based approach, and FDA's deviation from that approach is arbitrary and capricious. The bottom line here is that Vyvanse does not contain a new active ingredient. Vyvanse didn't contain a new active ingredient when Shire submitted its NDA to FDA. Vyvanse did not contain a new active ingredient when FDA granted Vyvanse NC exclusivity. Instead, Vyvanse contains what's called listdexamfetamine, which I'll refer to as LDX. LDX, quite simply, is just not an active molecule. Instead, once it's ingested, LDX is cleaved, and only dextroamphetamine travels to and acts on receptors in the brain. And what is dextroamphetamine? Dextroamphetamine is a molecule that is decades old. It's been in use since the 1970s to treat ADHD. There is no cogent reason why Congress would have intended to give new chemical entity exclusivity to a molecule that was decades old. As to the first question for this court regarding the statute, the district court misread this court's decision in Abbott v. Young. Abbott v. Young is simply not controlling here. The court in Abbott was dealing with a different issue. The court was dealing with the words "the active ingredient" inside of the parenthetical in the statute. And specifically, the court was dealing with or found that those words were ambiguous as to whether it referred to the first approved or the later approved active ingredient. That's not the issue before this court. The issue before this court are whether the words "active ingredient" before the parenthetical compels FDA to apply an activity-based approach. And the text, structure, and purpose of the statute all lead to that result. Congress reserved the extraordinary 5-year new chemical entity exclusivity for the approval of a new active ingredient. Congress intentionally modified the word "ingredient" with the word "active." And in doing so, Congress removed any ambiguity as to whether the ingredient needs to be active and whether activity is relevant. Of course it is, because that's what Congress said. The way that the proper interpretation should work is FDA should look for the active molecule. And once it identifies the active molecule, FDA should look at whether the active molecule has been previously approved or whether a salt or ester of that molecule has been previously approved. And if it has, as it does with respect to Vyvanse and LDX, FDA should deny NC exclusivity. In addition to the text of the statute, the structure and purpose of the statute also mandate an activity-based approach. Quite simply, Hatch-Waxman adopted two main types of exclusivity for brand companies. There's the 5-year exclusivity we've been talking about, and there's the 3-year exclusivity. The purpose of the 3-year exclusivity was to give an incentive for changes made or improvements made to previously approved ingredients. One of those main improvements is the delayed release of an active ingredient. Here, LBX Shire claims that's what it achieves. It achieves a delayed release of the previously approved dextroamphetamine. As a result, it should have been given 3-year exclusivity, not 5-year exclusivity. In fact, FDA's approach completely eviscerates the distinction between 3-year and 5-year exclusivity that Congress intended, and it eviscerates the incentive for innovation that Congress came up with to incent brand companies to come up with new active molecules. And doing so is improper. I'm sorry.
I understand that at one level this is kind of, you know, a Chevron case. And I have to say, since your argument depends on a finding that this is not ambiguous, I've struggled a bit with the chemistry here. But one thing that immediately occurs to me is we're not talking about the statute, right? I mean, we're not talking about active ingredient. You're actually talking about the regulation, which almost suggests that there is ambiguity. In other words, at least the dissent in Abbott said, active ingredient is not an ambiguous term. It does not include active moiety. But you are saying exactly that, if I understand your argument, correct?
We are saying that, and in fact, that's the position FDA took in leading up to Abbott. In the McNeil letter, FDA took the position that active ingredient means active moiety, and essentially construed in its regulation what it determined active moiety means. This court in Abbott v. Young actually, I think, came to a pretty clear conclusion of what active moiety mean, and actually both the majority and the dissent agreed that active moiety meant the active molecule in the body, the molecule that had activity in the body. Kind of getting to your first point there, Your Honor, we believe we are dealing with the statute, that we are dealing with what the statute means when it says active ingredient and giving meaning to those words. FDA's approach essentially guts the meaning of those words. It takes all meaning away from the word active. We're trying to give meaning to it as what we believe Congress intended.
You're saying that the regulations cannot withstand scrutiny, or the application of the regulations?
We believe it's an application of the regulations. We believe there is a good reading of the regulation. If you look at the regulation, so the regulation says active moiety means a molecule or ion, and it excludes certain portions, and then it says that is responsible for the physiological or pharmacological action of the drug substance. There is a reading of the regulation that is consistent with the statute, and it's a reading that essentially treats the active moiety as what we believe it is, the molecule.
But that's not Chevron step one. Once you concede that the regulation does not fail under Chevron, then we're at a different interpretation. The coterminous to some extent, but it's whether or not the agency has properly construed and applied its regulations in this particular case.
Well,
in answer to Judge Brown, you're essentially conceding there's no Chevron argument here. This is an application of the regulations case.
No, we think there is a Chevron argument.
No, you can't have it. I just asked you specifically because you confused me.
I'm sorry.
I thought you were arguing Chevron 1. That would have to be about whether the regulation can't stand. You just said, yes, regulation's fine. So we're talking about an application of the regulation case, which is a different set of tests.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, and I didn't mean to be confusing. To the extent that FDA reads its regulation one way, and we think FDA actually has been reading it the way we think it should be read in applying an activity-based approach, but the extent that FDA here has applied a strict structure-based approach, that reading is inconsistent with the statute.
That's not a Chevron case. If you start with the premise that the regulation, in your view, does not fail Chevron, it's a perfectly fine regulation. We think they made a mistake in applying it here. We're not talking Chevron. We're talking a set of cases about whether the agency has properly construed and applied its lawful regulation, right?
I think the court can come out both ways here. I think
no,
the court
we can't. No, no, your case.
No,
you've got to just like I said, counsel. You decide. You tell me what you're doing, and what you're doing is not a Chevron case.
Well,
the regulation passes Chevron, and you agree the regulation applies. They just did it wrong, is what you're saying, under their own regulation.
I think they have done it wrong
under their lawful regulation, right?
It is lawful if you read it.
And you can make. Don't be afraid of what I'm suggesting.
No, I'm not.
But I've got to get the theory straight.
I understand.
You're saying that even under that set of cases, Judge Edwards, they still can't be inconsistent in the application. I mean, that's what I'm hearing your argument to be now.
I think there are two arguments. I think that's certainly one argument. I think the other argument is the statute does, under Chevron Step 1, compel the FDA to apply an activity-based approach.
Now, I don't know how you can have it both ways. If the regulation is good and they have the authority to promulgate the regulation, then the regulation's in play and the case has to be decided under the regulation.
Under the regulation?
Yeah.
I think if the agency is acting inconsistent with the statute, then the regulation can be thrown out as well.
Well, I'm just trying to understand what your argument is. Either the regulation is good or bad. You say sometimes they apply the lawful,
right,
facially lawful regulation correctly in your view, and sometimes they don't. But I'm trying to get what you're saying about the regulation. You say the regulation is okay.
I think the regulation can be okay, and that its application here is improper.
All right.
That's right. I'm sorry, I see my time is up. As we also said in our papers, we believe FDA has consistently been applying an activity-based approach. I'd be happy to answer questions about that or anything else. Thank you.
Mr. Lamb.
I was wondering which way he was going. It's really confusing.
May it please the court, Andrew Clark for the Federal Appellees. To go directly to the point that Judge Brown and Judge Edwards were just discussing, I don't think there's any question that we've moved to Chevron 2 from the get-go here, because activists has already conceded that active ingredient as used in this provision should be and can be, you know, properly interpreted as active moiety. What they argue about is how FDA interprets active moiety. But if we're there, we're talking about how FDA interprets its regulation, and we've already moved beyond the plain language of the statute to the interpretation that the Abbott Court, you know, essentially sanctioned, you know, when they remanded it to FDA. Once we get to the issue of how you define an active moiety at Chevron 2, where the district court looked at it, it's really a misnomer to say we're talking about the difference between an activity-based approach and a structural approach. It's simply not correct that FDA is ignoring the activity of the molecule. FDA considers the activity of the drug, but it does so by reference to the known properties of certain chemical structures. In other words, instead of attempting to determine exactly how a molecule or a portion of the molecule is going to behave inside somebody's body in every case, which may not even be possible in every case, FDA relies upon what it knows about how various types of structural modifications affect the activity of a drug based upon its experience and its expertise. So FDA's regulation distinguishes between modifications to previously approved molecules that, in the agency's experience, are likely to change the activity of the drug and represent a significant innovation, such as non-ester covalent derivatives, as opposed to those that are not likely to represent a significant change to the previously approved moiety, like salts and esters that the statute mentions. So FDA's approach, which for shorthand we've called a structural-based approach, considers the activity, but it does so by way of the agency's experience and expertise with what it knows about structural forms. It's a clear, straightforward approach, easy to administer, which is not a bad thing, unlike the approach that Advocus advocates. And more importantly, it provides clarity and certainty to drug sponsors. The critical point, though, is that once you're at Chevron Step 2, it's not a question of which approach is the better approach. The question is FDA's approach permissible? It only needs to be reasonable. And I think the district court was very, very, very cogently dealt with that issue. It's a scientific area. FDA is relying on its scientific expertise. It's construing an ambiguity in its own statute. Unless there's something in the statute that unambiguously requires FDA to approach it the way activists are suggesting, there's no reason why, under a classic Chevron Step 2 analysis, FDA's construction here, which has been on the books for over 15 years and consistently applied, does not pass muster.
One question that I do have, Mr. Clark, activists makes an argument here that branded companies could keep this five-year exclusivity going indefinitely by sort of bonding one therapeutic ingredient to a whole variety of chemical moieties, if I understand what they're arguing here. That does seem somewhat in tension with the point of Hatch-Waxman, which is we're trying to balance, you know, encouraging innovation with getting cheap drugs quickly to consumers. So are they right about this argument that they're making?
No, they're not right, Judge Brown. It's speculation. When you're developing a drug, you're looking at, you know, all possible ways to innovate and create new drugs. If a drug, you know, I don't want to get into what hypothetical ways that, you know, a drug company could possibly develop a new drug, but if a drug company goes through the trouble of coming up with a new modification, and it's a covalent modification to a previously approved moiety, and they go through the clinical tests, and they determine that this is a drug that has some new novel benefit, or that it somehow significantly changes the previous drug, there would be nothing inherently absurd about rewarding that innovation and that research and development with.
You couldn't reward it 5 years or 3 years.
And you would, depending on whether it is a new moiety or not. It gets the 3 years if you do the studies, but you're not creating a new moiety, but you still had to do studies for whatever reason. But if you created a new moiety, and under FDA's definition, that means, in general, if you added a new covalent bond to it, or there are a number of other things that could create a new moiety, but FDA's experience is that when you do attach a new covalent derivative to a previously approved moiety, that you're creating something innovative and different, that it's going to behave in unexpected and different ways, that even a slight change in structure can lead to big differences. And that's why FDA, you know, based the regulation on that distinction.
What would be an example in this situation with this drug to warrant 3 years instead of five?
Very simply, Judge Edwards, if the drug were not required studies for whatever reason, perhaps a new formulation, a new use or something, but it was still the same same active moiety. If it was, you know, only changed by
active moiety here too.
Here, not under FDA's definition, it's not the same active moiety because it's dextroamphetamine is the old moiety. This is dextroamphetamine linked with a covalent bond to lysine. And as you've seen from the briefs and the record below, the parties dispute whether the new lysine appendage changes the activity in any significant way.
I can understand how that could be described as a new active moiety, but how is it a new chemical entity? Isn't that the focus of this statute?
Well, the statute, of course, uses the term active ingredient, which is something actually completely different. But FDA's interpreted active ingredient to mean active moiety, which is essentially a new chemical entity. What FDA, you know, looked at was that at the time Congress was enacting Hatch-Waxman, FDA had in place a system for classifying drugs, and one of the classifications, what was called a type 1 chemical, was a new molecular entity. And FDA had always defined new molecular entities as something with a new active moiety. So new chemical entity, new active moiety, all essentially the same thing that we're talking about. And the only dispute in this case is whether when you're trying to decide what makes a new active moiety, do you have to actually look at what it does in the body, you know, what kind of activity, where the activity is, what it does, or can you draw upon the agency's experience and expertise and simply look at the structure alone and say, hey, based on what we know about these kinds of changes, this, in our judgment, is sufficient to create a new chemical entity, a new active moiety. And at Chevron Step 2, that's plenty good enough, as Judge Collier
recognized. I'm not understanding how we're doing a Chevron Step 2. They are conceding the regulation applies. You're relying on the regulation. The regulation is what's at issue. They're not saying the regulation's inconsistent with the statute. It's the Thomas and Jefferson and that whole line of cases that we're looking at. If they're conceding the regulation is lawful and applies, and they're fighting over your application over your own regulation, that should be the focus of the case.
Well, I don't want to make their case for them.
Well, I'm telling you what I'm hearing from them, and I'm curious to hear your answer, and I'm curious that you're not responding on those terms. They're saying the regulation is lawful and it applies. You just applied it incorrectly.
I think they're arguing a little more than that. I think they're trying to argue that...
Well, how about go with my weak understanding of what they're saying. Let's pretend that maybe I heard them say that the regulation is lawful.
We'd be happy to have that be the interpretation. If that's the case, and we're talking about is the application lawful, there can be little doubt, because the application, the regulation itself is crystal clear. If it's a covalent modification, it's a new active moiety and a new chemical entity. If it's a non-covalent, a salt or an ester, it's not. So FDA's regulation, I don't think there can be much question. And Judge Collier addressed the application of the regulation, and she found that there was no real question that FDA's, under the clear terms of FDA's regulation, this drug, listdexamphetamine, I apologize, passed muster. Our position is that even though dextroamphetamine is, no question, an old moiety, that when you listdexamphetamine, which is dextroamphetamine covalently bonded with lysine, under FDA's regulation, is a new active moiety. It's new and different enough based on its structure alone that FDA considers it eligible for the reward.
You still can't give me a concrete example of the same drug that gets the 3 years instead of the 5 years. What would happen to
it? It would simply be if it did not meet the terms of the statute.
A real example.
A drug that...
What? Take this drug, and what would you do to this drug that would warrant 3 as opposed to 5 years?
Well, if you take dextroamphetamine and link it with an ester, but still have to do studies to, you know, for whatever reason that are essential to approval, you know, I don't know in what scenario FDA would require studies essential for approval, possibly a new formulation, a new intended use. But the distinction between 3 and 5 years is simply based on is it a new active moiety or not under the regulation.
No, I understand that, but that's just going around in circles. I'm curious to hear what that means to you.
Well, Your Honor, I would have to speculate.
In real terms.
I would have to speculate in terms of when FDA would require studies, new studies essential for approval of a different molecule. But in this case, they required, not only did they require studies, but it was also... met the requirement for active moiety, so it met the 5-year hurdle as well as the 3-year hurdle. I'm sure there are examples where, ample examples in history. I mean, FDA doesn't approve that many new chemical entities every year. There are plenty of times when FDA awards 3-year but not 5-year. I see my time is up. If there are no further questions, I'll thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Landman, we'll give you back 2 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a few issues very quickly, and starting with Judge Brown's question on the successive periods of exclusivity. Mr. Clark responded that, you know, that's mere speculation. Well, Shire doesn't believe it's mere speculation. In fact, Shire has told the USPTO in its patent application, or in its issued patent, that there are multiple different moieties to stick onto the active dextroamphetamine, all with the same effect of releasing dextroamphetamine in the body. Under FDA's approach that's applying now, Shire will get successive periods of 5-year exclusivity. Also wanted to touch on Judge Edwards' question on the 3 versus 5 year. Mr. Clark kept referring to studies. The number of studies is completely irrelevant.
I agree. I'm trying to get a concrete example in my head. It can't be about studies, but no one's given me an
sure.
example.
One such example, which is often the case, is an extended release version of an active molecule. If you then come up with an extended release version, you go to FDA, you really do about the same number of studies and about the same studies that Shire did with LDX, and you prove it up, and you then get 3-year exclusivity. And the reason is FDA looks at it and says, that's not a new active molecule. I shouldn't give it 5-year exclusivity. I should only give it 3-year exclusivity.
But they have the extended release cases is an example of 3 years as opposed to 5.
That's right, Your Honor. Yeah. And just quickly, one last thing I just wanted to clarify, the extent it didn't come through in our papers, is on the arbitrary and capricious action in FDA's behavior FDA's actions in applying the activity-based approach. The district court fundamentally misunderstood our citation to FDA's MAP. We didn't cite the MAP as a controlling statute or regulation. We simply couldn't have done that because it's not. Our citation of the MAP was merely to show a chronicle of FDA's history of applying an activity-based approach. And we cited, just quickly, we cited esters such as ISMM, complexes such as gadoteridol, where FDA 6 times applied an activity-based approach, and even another amide such as fosaprepitant. In all of those instances, FDA applied an activity-based approach, and we believe it's arbitrary and capricious for FDA not to have done so here. Unless there are any other questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you.